Hey y'all, and welcome to episode 11 of The Early Team. In this episode, I speak with Sanjay Krishna, who leads growth at Kolum, an early stage startup backed by Sequoia. Sanjay started his journey in corporate law and then eventually ran his own edtech venture, which ended in a soft exit. In this conversation, we talk about his career and the force behind wanting to join a smaller company, how his corporate law experience has been empowering his success in the sales role, and the similarities that he sees between playing tennis and working at an early stage company. With that, let's dive in, and I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Rob Conversations with contributors at early stage startups. Immersed in ambiguity and navigating the unknowns, we talk about how they figured it out or didn't. I'm your host, Shaheen Mosadegzad, and this is The Early Team. Sanjay, welcome to The Early Team. It's so good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Shaheen. Super excited to be here. Feel slightly underqualified, saw some awesome guests earlier, but hopefully this is helpful to some people.
Oh, absolutely. Contrary to what you just said, because what I'm looking forward to this conversation is you've got a background that I'm going to enjoy exploring here, because you've kind of done it all. And I don't want to, you know, take your thunder here. So before we jump into things, we'd love to hear a little bit about your story, where you're located, where you are today, and then we'll go from there. How does that sound?
Awesome. No, sounds good. To all the listeners, my name is Sanjay. I grew up between India and Singapore, and I'm currently based out of Bangalore. Now, okay. For my undergrad, I went to law school, and law school in India is 5 years. You mix it with a business degree where I learned absolutely nothing in the business classes. But law school was fun, right? Because this is a law school, so they don't really care about the business classes, but law school was fun. And in the process, I was just like, hey, let me figure out what kind of lawyer I really want to be. So I did I did criminal trial work, I did civil work, I did corporate work. And then I think, like a lot of people, decided to go into whole corporate law, kind of by accident, like interned at a top firm and they gave me the job. So it kind of made my decision for me. So my last 2 years of law school were basically me just having a good time because I had a great job in hand. And then the first 2 years of my career, I was a lawyer working with a team that specialized in work for startups, but also did a lot of M&A for larger companies as well. So I got to work on some amazing transactions, not just fundraising, but also exits. And that was like half my job. And the other half, which I actually kind of enjoyed more, was working with companies that were regulated, but there was some issue from a regulatory standpoint and helping them launch and manage the risk around it, right? So you think crypto, you think ride sharing. I'd worked with a bunch of startups that were like that were towing the line with the law. And that was when I realized, hey, I want to be on the other side of the table, right? So I got to work with some amazing founders. And just hanging out with them, I was like, hey, these are the guys creating impact. As a lawyer, I'm just enabling it. So right in the pandemic, I was like, hey, screw this. Let's try something new. I'm young enough, have savings. And decided to start my own company called Worldwise. And that was in education, because that was what I felt particularly strongly about. We started off with a product that would teach kids in school things that school didn't teach them. So it was like mental health, nutrition, financial literacy, and turned out it bombed. First 3 months, no traction whatsoever, because kids in India apparently just need to crack exams, get into a good college, and that's all parents care about. Of course, we made a bunch of rookie mistakes along the way, but in the process, realized we should try and sell to people who make the decision themselves. And that was one of the biggest learnings we had, because when you sell to kids, you need to sell to both the kid and the parent, right? So then we quickly moved to an audience that we understood, which was like, hey, nobody in law school knows anything. Why don't we win like masterclass for lawyers? And we also built like an alternate law school universe. And that was super fun. So it started with us teaching ourselves, because we had some pedigree, my co-founder and I, because we went to top law firms. And then it became like masterclass. So super fun shooting courses with the best lawyers in the country, bootstrapped it, got to thousands of users, students. But again, market was small, because how many lawyers are there? 70,000 lawyers, right? And of course, we were catering to a bunch of them, but we realized it was never going huge. So we started actively looking out for people who were maybe interested in this. Unicorn in the edtech space actually thought it was a great fit. So we ended up selling the IP, the courses. And then after that, I was like, hey, let me take a break, figure out what I want to do, because I was tired. Spent 2 months at OnDeck also, spoke to a bunch of cool startups, and decided that Kolum sounded incredibly cool. And Indus, who's the founder, was someone who just I really wanted to work with. I had a great interview with. I loved his background. So I was like, okay, fine, let's do this. And I, funnily enough, got hired without a job description. He reached out to me. He said, you look cool. I said, hey, I think your company is cool. We chatted thrice, and that's how it happened.
Well, one, congrats on landing job at Kolum. That sounds exciting, and we'll get to it. But I just have so many questions, and so why don't we just dive in from the beginning? Walk me through from the beginning as you come out of law school, and you've explored criminal law, you're exploring corporate law, and you land in this nice area where you get to be on the other side, working with the founders and helping them enable their approach while working with regulators. You mentioned you talked with some cool founders. What were some things that you learned during that time that you wouldn't have learned elsewhere as a corporate lawyer?
Got it. So I think as a corporate lawyer, a lot of my colleagues and batchmates, right, from law school, folks who were in my graduating class, they were doing straightforward run-of-the-mill VC and M&A deals that I was also doing, like 60% of the time, right? But right. The other 30-40%, what was really interesting was seeing founders toe the line, even in terms of product decisions, and linking that to like regulatory risk, right? I'll give you a very simple example. This is 2019. And Think of BlaBlaCar. Do you know BlaBlaCar?
I'm not familiar.
Ride sharing. Yeah, got it. It's think of it as a carpooling service where you go in your friend's car. He gets to drop you off somewhere and you pay him a cut. So it could be your friend. It could be a stranger on the internet. So think Airbnb for like regular drivers, but the folks driving you aren't like taxi drivers. They're regular drivers, right? So we're working with this startup where, so if I'm sitting in a stranger's car, the obvious risk for a regulator is that's not a car that has a commercial license. So there's no insurance for the passenger. So for some reason, if, let's say, an accident happens, what happens to the passenger? Big regulatory question there. And that's why they said, hey, you can't do this business. But what was interesting was the regulator said, you can't do this business if you're doing it for profit. So then what we tried to do was we tried to design a cost structure for each ride where we're saying, hey, we are only paying for the fuel. So the driver's not doing this for profit. It is something they're doing out of goodwill. So that's a classic example of product being, or let's say how the product is built is fundamentally altered by, let's say, regulatory action. And that was things I was having fun with doing.
Got it. Just one quick question on that. Was when you say paying for gas, was it at gas prices at the moment, or was it, price gauged a little bit to bring in some revenue still while paying for gas?
No, so it was an interesting question. So there was gas, and we had to figure out what kind of cost can we add, which is okay, and what kind of cost can we add that's not okay. So a big question there was depreciation, right? Because I argued that, hey, you can't pass depreciation on to the rider. Because when you bought the car, there was no intent for you to actually use it to ferry other people, right? So we had to look at each cost involved in a ride. And every car model had a different pricing mechanism. It was super fun doing that exercise. But I think that what we realized, and also what the founders realized, not us rather, was that people weren't really doing this for the intention of profit, right? They were going to work anyway. They're happy to drop someone off. It's just a little bit of pocket money. So the 10 rupee or the 10 cent delta wouldn't be significant to them.
That's great. Okay. And that's a great example. So thank you for sharing that. As you're working these deals, working with these founders, you're talking to early stage companies and corporates. What were some similarities between the two for you that could go one way to the other? And then what were the differences working with, like, say, startups than corporate and the deals that were happening?
Got it. No, I think super interesting question. And I also think it is a little bit hard to generalize, but one thing for sure was I always felt a heightened sense of urgency at startups. Across the road, decision was less bureaucratic. The number of people that needed to sign off on calls were less. In a lot of cases, the number of meetings itself were less, because especially when it came to fundraising, people wanted to close rounds quickly. And it was often seen as, hey, the lawyers are the guys who are stopping this from happening. It should have happened 2 weeks ago, but for the lawyers, right? So I feel like startups generally moved quicker. And they also, as a general rule, had a higher appetite for risk, maybe just the nature of it. But once companies get larger, especially once they list, they are a lot more conservative from a compliance, governance, et cetera, standpoint. So I think that was true as a whole. But I also had the chance. So I was working out of a large corporate for 2 months when a large M&A deal was happening. So Flipkart got acquired by Walmart, $16 billion deal, the largest M&A deal in India. And at that point, I was working out of Flipkart's office. And that's when I realized that even at that massive scale, there were still people who were taking decisions quickly. There was urgency. So I wouldn't say that this is something that across the board, hey, large organizations are slow, because I've seen people move really, really fast, even at scale.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great example as well. So you've been working on these deals. You're working with different founders. You're working with corporates. At what stage as a lawyer were you then thinking about, hey, maybe I want to do something on my own, and then we can kind of get to Worldwise? But I'm curious of what your thought process was. How did you make that decision? Because that is a big jump going from, you know, being a corporate lawyer, and this is an assumption, but maybe you're getting paid well, to then, no, I'm going to go to the complete opposite route where I'm like, it's me and my co-founder or co-founders, and we're starting something from scratch.
Yeah, no. So I think my thought process was fairly simple, I think. I was slightly bored, to be honest. Work was starting to get repetitive. So this kind of regulatory stuff was the interesting bit, 30%. But the day-to-day transactional work, I had gotten a little bored. I don't think I was challenged. And that was my biggest problem. The second big problem was when I looked at the partners, and I loved working with the partners of the firm. A lot of them remain super close friends. I hang out with them even now. I realized that I didn't really want to live their life, because in a service industry, you're always on call. Friday, 10 p.m., you're still on call. I pulled way too many Friday night all-nighters. I've seen way too many sunrises in the office. It's very intense. So while the pay is great, I realized that maybe I don't want the life of a partner, because the work didn't excite me enough to justify that lifestyle. And I was like, hey, I'm in my mid-20s. I can take risks. And thankfully, I come from a family of privilege, so education here is cheap anyway, so I didn't have any debt and I had a lot of savings. So I had 2 years of runway in the bank in terms of personal runway. And I also knew that if I wanted to go back to the law, I could get a job super easily, because I had 2 years at a great, great law firm. So getting a job would not be difficult. So the downside was super low, right? Now add that to the fact that this was right when COVID hit. So I was like, I'm going to be moving back home anyway, so I don't have too much cost. And EdTech then was just picking up. There was like, hey, everyone's moving online. Nobody knows what to do. So I think a combination of all these factors meant that I could move. And thankfully, I didn't have any like FOMO about money I wasn't making, because we didn't make money for the first 4 or 5 months, really. But there was no real FOMO, because it didn't really matter.
Gotcha. Okay. Given that, you know, this podcast is mostly focused on being an operator at an early stage company, I don't want to dive too deep into Worldwise, but I would love to hear kind of like what the early days were like for you and the founders. You talked about pivoting from educating kids and things that they don't teach in school to then going to educating people in law school and et cetera like that. Walk me through the early days. What was that like, especially as you all made a difficult decision to transition and pivot to a new model?
Yeah, no, I think the first 3 months were super hard, because we were like, hey, this is something I wish I had as a kid, right? And that was always our thought process when we were building products. What were things we wish we had? So it started off with what is something I wish I had in school? And then it became what is something I wish I had in law school, right? And that was kind of the thinking. We were putting ourselves in our own shoes younger, right? And I think it was hard in the first few months just not to see traction. But we kind of knew it would happen because we didn't have any, we didn't think we were great entrepreneurs starting out or anything like that, right? We knew that the downside was there. And I think we learned a lot from the process, right? And the biggest thing we learned from that first stage was holding the attention of a kid is really difficult. And turns out that's also difficult for adults. So if you can crack the attention problem for a kid, you definitely can crack it for an adult. So there were a bunch of smaller learnings that we took that we then applied to the legal education product. And for the legal education product, of course, the advantage that we had was we had a lot of natural social proof built in because we had partnered with a lot of top law firms to get them to hire people because we had the network. We had a lot of top lawyers teaching on the platform that came in slowly. But our own credentials were very, very strong while building that. So even though it was bootstrapped, we were able to execute quickly. And I think that was a big learning. The other thing was we built distribution just on organic social media fairly well, I'd say. And I think like LinkedIn, all of that proved to be great channels. And WhatsApp, we ran a WhatsApp newsletter that exploded. So I think just using organic, we had a bunch of lessons, which I think continue to hold me in good stead.
Can you talk about the WhatsApp newsletter? I've never heard that and it sounds super fascinating.
Yeah,
how, how does that work?
Yeah, so everyone does email, right?
And yeah.
The problem with email is kids don't open emails. And India, people love WhatsApp. So we were just like, hey, let's do a newsletter on WhatsApp. So it's now a thing. There are a bunch of them. A friend was running a WhatsApp newsletter that I really liked. And the resource, what we created on WhatsApp was a lot of kids who are not in, let's say, the top 5-10 universities. There's a massive information asymmetry. They don't have access to resources, knowledge, etc. And by that, I mean, they don't know what a good, let's say, CV looks like. They don't know what a nice SOP is, all of that stuff, right? So these were high-quality resources that we would distribute on WhatsApp. And since we were on WhatsApp, we had their phone number. They could engage with us quickly. And there was a community formed on top of that. So we got to about almost 8,500 people just on WhatsApp. Because it was just proving a lot more effective than email.
Yeah, and at the same time, you're building a community. Like, to be honest with you, maybe I just don't know anything about this and WhatsApp or in the States, but like that's the first time I've heard of it, and that's very clever. And at what point, though, did you all end up hiring people as well, or was it mostly just the two of you throughout the entire course of the business?
So we hired a bunch of interns, but we didn't have anyone full-time.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. Yep. So bootstrapped to its core. At what stage did you then start exploring potentially selling the business? And then part two of that question, how did your experience as a lawyer help you navigate this exit?
I think we decided to sell because we realized, so the first thing we realized was we knew we didn't want to build a legal education product, which is why it was called Worldwise. It was never called Law XYZ, right? It was very much by design. But then what we realized was when you have to build for, so our next plan was to go into policy and a bunch of these related niches, right? But the problem was we realized that every time you create a new course, you need to create distribution from scratch. And that is a massive problem because you're selling to a different person each time. So without scale, it was super difficult. And the TAM was slightly small, which became a problem for us. And that's when we were growing well, but it would never be like massive, right? It would never be a $100 million business. And that's when we took the call. And when we entered, my co-founder and I, we were like, we're going to be very pragmatic about this. Let it grow. If it grows well, great. And I think we made good money. We didn't make any life-changing money. But money was great. No problems. But we were like, let's be pragmatic about where this is 5 years from now. And then we realized, hey, this is not happening. So we just cold emailed folks saying, hey, we built something awesome. We know it's awesome, but we don't want to do this for 10 years. These are our metrics. What do you think? Couple of people replied. Then long drawn out process, which I really don't want to go into, but it's slow, painful. Yeah. But funnily enough, the contracts, etc., I just drafted and reviewed those contracts myself. So we didn't engage a counsel, nothing. But I was like, hey, I can draft this contract. It's fine. And it was fairly straightforward. So being a lawyer,
and I'm sure you.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and I'm sure you were able to retain substantial amount of funds by doing it yourself during
Yeah, that's
the
for
during the
sure.
exit.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's for sure.
Okay. Cool. So you mentioned they acquire the IP and the courses and the users. So if I'm understanding, you yourself didn't transition over to that company, right? At that point, you're like, this is kind of the exit from the business itself.
That's kind of correct. So I still, both my co-founder and I are still consulting with them. So we
Okay.
do, we have like a part-time model. So I spend a bunch of hours every month working with them to help them develop and refine their product. And we do a bunch of, because we have some distribution ourselves, we do a bunch of events. Funnily enough, I was doing one of those events today as well, but it's not too much time. Just help them out with the transition. And that's like a long-term engagement where we consult with them for their legal education vertical.
Gotcha. Okay. How is it being on the other side where you're a consultant for the thing you built? How has that transition been for you? Does it feel weird? Is it awkward? Or is it like, no, I actually love this, that I actually don't have the stress of building and I can just do what I love best, and that's the education part of it.
I think it's pretty great. For one thing, I'm not a consultant for what we've built per se, because what we've built itself is enabling their larger product. So I get to look into their larger product and help them with distribution. For the most part, it's just fun because it allows me to stay in touch with my old network. It's always fun solving problems that you've thought about deeply, but now you're doing it
Yeah.
without the stress of, hey, I'm bootstrapped. What's going to happen the next month? So
Exactly.
I think it's kind of a really nice place to be. It's comfortable because I feel like if I hadn't consulted, I'd miss it and I'd want visibility. Because it's hard leaving something you've built, right? There's a lot of emotional attachment. So I think
Yeah.
that it's kind of nice to go back to old roots every once in a while.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so you exit. You get acquired, you're consulting, you found OnDeck. How did the conversations with Colm start? Did you find them? Did they find you? And what kind of led to the subsequent conversations where you're ultimately like, okay, there's no job description, but I think this is a good opportunity for both parties?
Super question. Let me try and be structured about it. So one day, Indus, who's the founder, Indus reached out to me through the OnDeck, what was then Talent Hub. Think of it as like a networking LinkedIn portal. So he like cold DM'd me
Sure.
saying, hey, you guys look, your profile looks interesting. Do you want to chat? At that point, I was just chatting with people for fun. Right. So I said, sure.
Yeah.
And that was an interview, but wasn't an interview. And I was, he's, and so me being me, I was like, let me stalk the guy before I take this call because I like doing my research. And turned out he had sold his first startup to Oracle. He'd made an exit and he was doing this because he was just passionate about building, right? That's how people
Yeah.
are. So I was like, hey, this sounds like someone who's really cool. I want to talk to him. So then I deep dived into the product and then I just got on call. I was a half an hour chat just about my story, his story, what I was doing, and I was like, hey, I'm on break, I'm trying to figure out what to do. And he's like, okay, cool. What do you think about what you're building? I'm like, it sounds interesting. And at that point, they came to market like 2 months ago. So they
Yeah.
had just come out and hit the market. So I was like, oh, okay, super interesting. And I was like, okay, fine, let's chat. And then we had another chat, and then where whatever, interesting conversation. And he's like, do you want to work here? I was like, okay, cool. And then there was an assignment and then a final interview, and that just kind of happened from there. I had a bunch of other offers at the time, and at that point I was just like, where do I want to go? But my thought process there was primarily that I know at some point I want to do something on my own again, and I want to avoid making rookie mistakes again. And I thought that learning from someone who's been there, done that, would be super, super helpful. So that was the number one metric I was optimizing for. And I think the second thing was I like solving different things every day. I love being a founder because no day is alike. And I thought that this
Right.
kind of setup, which is also true, I think, for all early stage roles, and I'm sure like all your other guests have alluded to as well, my job description changes all the time and I love it. I love the chaos of it. I love the ambiguity. And that's why I was like, okay, so like a couple of my other offers were at large, like 1,000-person teams and another small place also. But I was like, okay, this is what I kind of weighed and decided to go with Colin.
I love that. I think you touch on something huge here where you knew where you wanted to go, which is be a founder again or explore your own thing. And then you're like, where are the gaps that I can fill or learn in my next step? We actually talked about this in the previous episode with a guest of like, he knew where he wanted to end up. And he's like, what do I need to do in the meantime to get up there? So that's wonderful. And then the founder mentality, I think a lot of times you touched on it, is when you're coming in early, you're pretty much part of the founding team, whatever the title is, and you do need to have the founder mentality and trying to figure things out. Because as you mentioned, your day-to-day changes all the time. There's chaos, there's ambiguity, and you really got to have a little bit of itch for wanting to solve that. And I think that just comes with it. So when you started, well, before we even get to that, can you tell us what Kolem is, what the product and the company does, and then we'll kind of dive into your day-to-day and how things have changed for you.
Awesome. Super. So at Kolem, we're backed by Sequoia and Nexus. We're about a 25-person team, and we solve a super interesting problem. Today, you have millions of tools that sell you software, but a large company today has 200-plus tech tools. SMB or even a venture-funded startup will have at least 50 tech tools, even at 25 employees, but you have no tools to manage them, right? So we do a couple of things. One, we issued the world's first card that exclusively pays for SaaS, cloud, media, and digital. So you can't buy Starbucks coffee. You can't buy an airline ticket. The only thing you can do is buy SaaS, cloud, media, and digital, because then it's on one dashboard. Now, why does this one dashboard matter? A, because then we can track whether you're actually using the apps. So you'll be surprised, but I've seen like a 50-person startup having 20 Zoom licenses unused. And that's like burning money. Like, I know startups burn money, but this is like stupid burning of money. They're like, so what we realized is like the average startup is wasting like 30% of their SaaS budget. And we solve it in multiple different ways. One, we track what they actually use. Two, we help them get the best deals. And three, we kind of streamline a bunch of things for finance, from payments to collecting invoices and a bunch of stuff that's early stage startups don't care about. And then when they reach like a late stage, they're like, oh shit, I'm in trouble. So we solve a lot of that. And it's been fun.
Sanjay, people can't see me, but like I have my hand, like my head in my hands, because I've always had this running joke is like, how many more tools can we sign up for that we don't use? So love the idea. Love the product. I think it's a great tool. And so you come in, how many people were at the company when you joined? So you mentioned there's like 20 something right now. What range were you in?
We had a product and dev team that was around 15 people at the time. But I was the first non-product dev engineering hire. So the first business hire, so to speak. So I think that's when I came in. Since then, we've hired another salesperson and hiring more people in sales. We're also hiring people across multiple roles if anyone wants to check us out. I think I was the first non-engineer. I don't know what employee number I was. I know people wear it as a badge of pride, but I honestly don't know. But somewhere between 15 and 20, I think.
There you go. Yeah, when you're that early, JDs don't matter, numbers don't matter. It's you wear many hats, so you could technically be number 15 to 20 yourself. Okay, so you mentioned the first growth person. When you started, you've had these conversations with the founder. You kind of have a good idea what the product is. But when you showed up, those first 30, 60, 90 days, were things different than what you had expected? Like, what were they? Your expectations were met, but then also things that came up, you're like, this is not what I was thinking at all.
So it was actually super funny. The first day I joined, we were announcing a strategic partnership. And this is like, hey, can you fire up a quick blog? I'm like, okay, sure, I can write. So, and then I'm crafting a blog and I'm like, hey, I'm trying to figure out what the other partner does. So I spent like 3 hours figuring out what they do. Then I'm crafting the partnership announcement. Then, okay, I get a bunch of feedback and I'm like, okay, fine. This is straight in the deep end. And I loved it. I loved the fact that I had a lot of agency in the first 30, 60, 90 days to make mistakes and do like products, do a bunch of things that had high impact and that are now compounding into things that are getting us results, right? So overhauling the website, of course, it's happening again, but the first overhaul of the website happened then. Launched a bunch of campaigns on G2 for which we are now getting badges. We were not on G2. So I had to do a bunch of stuff that was really interesting then, and I had fun. What I was not expecting was, I think the biggest surprise for me was how quickly we were iterating on some of the messaging we were sending out. I thought there would be a little more. I feel like that was something that I was constantly testing and having fun with. And I think that took me by surprise. But then, of course, as data comes in, as you speak to more and more people, that was something that we consistently refined. But I don't think there were any other surprises per se. But I think that I think that was the biggest challenge in terms of just the speed of how quickly things were moving. Also because one fundamental difference between being bootstrapped and being venture run or venture backed rather is since there is more money, you have greater amount of data points potentially, right? Because you can hit more people, you can hit it quickly,
right?
And you have, it's faster that way. So I think that was one interesting thing. Also, even though we didn't have employees, I had like a roster of contractors that I was working with. So some guys for content, some guys for design, some guys for SEO. So just getting up to speed with, I was not used to working with a lot of contractors. So just that fundamental switch was important to me, but lots of learnings there as well.
Yeah. So you talk about like things moving quick, then you're changing things around, things are shifting quickly. How have you been able to kind of manage the short-term, quick, rapid changes, and then also then be able to kind of think long-term of how you want to build out your team and what kind of growth looks like, say, in 3 months? Because the time frames are smaller here. You can't think like 3, 4, 5 years ahead because things change so quickly. How have you been able to manage the balance between the two of short-term and long-term in this realm?
Got it. Super interesting question. I think one, the changing macroeconomic climate has resulted in a change of plans for us. So we are like a acyclical business. So people care for us more when the markets are bad. When it's a bull run, they're like, hey, who cares about saving? I just want growth, right? Because at the end of the day, onboarding a new tool, whatever, there is some friction involved. But right now, the attention on savings is a lot more. So because of the sudden change in the climate, and I joined in January. I joined early January. So the first 3 months, the climate was still kind of bullish. We're like, okay, we're pushing slow, we're getting traction, word of mouth, all of that. But now suddenly we're like, okay, let's put the foot on the gas. We've got a lot of customers coming in the last 2 months. And we're like, okay, now how do you add fuel to this fire? So I think in the last month, our hiring plans have changed. Now, of course, hiring for startups is a really difficult problem because quality candidates take a long time. You want to run them through 3, 4, 5, 6 rounds of interviews. So, of course, we are using contractors, et cetera, as a stopgap. But the idea is we are trying to add fuel to that fire. So it's largely dependent on, A, how the larger macro climate is, and also B, the traction we're seeing. I'm lucky to have a lot of momentum in the last couple of months since I've joined. So really want to kind of double down on that and make sure that we continue to grow.
That makes sense. And so adding fuel to the fire, and you mentioned you brought in your first salesperson, what type of, for this portion of growth, this fueling the fire, what type of individuals are you looking for? What skill set or mentality or personalities are you looking for to help drive that engagement and adding further fuel to the fire as you build out your team?
Got it. I think super question. It's super difficult because it's really hard to predict who's going to do well. And I feel that's particularly true in sales. I think it's super hard to tell who's going to do well. Probably easier for technical roles because you have a baseline of competence. But a lot of people who are really impressive in interviews somehow don't hit the ground running. At the same time, I've seen people who are okay in interviews end up doing really well, right? And this is also for like contractors we work with and we engage with. So I think a few core tenets that we are always looking for are, one is just ambition. Ambition is important. Ambition or drive, right? People wanting to succeed because at an early stage startup, you have to take ownership, right? Today, I am in growth, but I'm also de facto legal counsel. I also look at product for like, we're building like a contracting solution. So I look at product for one niche aspect of the product. I do customer service for a couple of customers because they're based in India and our customer service is in the US. So I'm the only guy who's awake. So my point is you want people who aren't afraid of taking up responsibility. So even if, let's say they're a sales guy, they're someone who'll go above and beyond and do a bunch of things. I think that's one thing. Two, I think something that people often under-index on, but we try and test for is general integrity. Trying to see that these are people who will always kind of do the right thing. I think that's a big part of the values in the company. And I think that's been great. And the third is actually people who value a transparent culture. We are a very transparent company. Everyone has open calendars. You can see what people are up to, even the founders. You know what the founders are up to right now. So we want people who are candid about, hey, today I'm taking time off. Yeah, I'm taking time off. It's fine. There's no need to hide anything. And also be transparent about your work input, your work output, what's working, what's not working. Because then the team can come in and kind of help you and support you. So I think that's the kind of people we're looking for, people who really like these values. Of course, having the skills is a prerequisite, but it's about making sure these values align as well.
Gotcha. And during your time so far at Qualm, earlier you mentioned, hey, I want to get to a point where I'm doing my own thing again. This is like a learning opportunity to really be learning from the founder. You've been there several months now. Looking back, like, what are some things that you've already learned that you'll potentially be taking with you in the future should that opportunity come where you want to do your own thing again?
God. So I think, and this is something I've thought about and I was reflecting upon recently, actually.
Yeah.
I think that I don't think I'm going to go back on my own for a couple of years because I still feel like I have a lot to learn. I'm still in like sponge mode, for lack of a better word. One is I am not a particularly process-oriented person. Of course, that kind of works for an early-stage startup, but you realize that building systems is hard. And that's not something I've actively had to think about in anything that I've had to really do. So I think one of the biggest learnings is creating systems that are kind of scalable. I think that's the first thing. Two, I'm also getting used to managing a larger number of people, something that I haven't had to do always. So I've had to manage a bunch of people, 3, 4, 5 people at a time. But now there are, with both direct and indirect reports, it's getting higher and higher. So I think that's also another challenge where I want to learn because I've realized one thing, that it's the team that kind of makes or breaks it. I've seen our product team, just because of how motivated, et cetera, they are, how much they feel for the problem, pull some truly amazing things on truly short timelines. And at the same time, when there is time off, we are having the time of our lives. It is super fun. I love hanging out with them, right? So just learning how to build a team. Like, I love sitting in on interviews with Indus, who's my founder, because I love the way he tries and analyzes people. And that's something, like, I feel I'm terrible at. I feel like I always think, hey, this is a guy. I kind of look at the best in someone. I'm like, hey, there's potential here. And I never know how to kind of weed that out. So I think a lot of smaller things that I continue to pick up. Some of it is very conscious. Some of it is unconscious, but I realize over time that, oh, okay, this is how my outlook has changed.
I got you. And so you've talked about the challenges and the learnings that are external, I would say. Now, looking inwards, what have you learned about yourself since you've started at Qualm and the things that you've seen, like the shift within you?
So I think the funny thing is that I thought that now that I'm not a founder, I would not be thinking about the problem a lot, but that's not true. So I always thought, hey, maybe it's only a founder problem that you obsess about the problem you're solving. I thought, okay, now that I'm an employee, maybe it's going to get better. But no, I think that on a random Saturday, I'll have a brainwave. And then I'm like, okay, let's get on Slack, get on Zoom, whatever. So I think that was one surprise. But I did definitely learn a bunch of things about myself that I didn't actually realize. But I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. The first is I realized that actually enjoyed sales a lot more than I thought I did earlier. So earlier, okay. we were heavily B2C with some B2B offerings at Worldwise. And now I'm like, hey, it's a lot more fun than I initially realized. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. Because funny enough, this is not a parallel that a lot of people see. But a lot of the skills I learned in law school were super helpful in sales. And I was like, hey, I didn't realize this is a fit. Because a lot of how you negotiate, how you position, these are things you've thought of in a different context. You just switch the context and it's fine, right? And I was like, okay, this is super fun.
And I love that.
And then I realized, hey, if 80% of this is stuff I know, I just need to switch the context. I was like, okay, this is super great. So I think a lot of things that I didn't actively think about in terms of what my skill sets are, I think that was like a discovery process that has happened for sure. I think the second thing that I definitely learned is that you always think that, and it's the whole Dunning-Kruger kind of thing, right? Where you think you know something, and then when you enter the startup, you're like, holy shit, I know nothing about this. And then Suddenly you're like, okay, 3 months in, you're like, okay, fine. Now I kind of know what's happening. I have a sense of what's happening. I know what we can do better. So I think that transition was always difficult, but I really enjoyed the transition, not just from like understanding the niche space, but also understanding how you can contribute to it. Right. So When you're hired without a job description, like, okay, I'm going to get 10 problems. They're going to get thrown at me. I'll solve some of them. If I don't know how to solve them, I'll pick up the phone and I'll get my friends or whatever to help me solve the others. And that's kind of the approach you have. But in the process, you very quickly figure out. And I think, and this is like a random conversation I was having with a friend, but I think an early stage startup or even starting up yourself is a great thing to do when you're young because you can figure out what you actually like. So I think, I think this whole career coaching thing is, like, I'm not a fan. Because I think it's very difficult for a third party to tell you what you're good at, what you truly enjoy. But if you're doing 10 different things, A, you'll figure out what you like, but more importantly, you'll figure out what you don't. And I think that's the bigger catch, right? You figure out what you don't want to do, and I'm like, okay, I'm not doing this. And I think that process has been amazing. And that's why I think there's a massive value in being a generalist there, I think.
Okay, so a few things that you touched on that I want to highlight. One is a lot of times when people are transitioning to a smaller company or they're thinking about career changes, oftentimes, and myself included, you don't really think about how the work that you're doing now translates over to the new world. And sometimes the similarities are a lot more if you dig a little deeper. So for example, when that help you be successful. So here, if you're someone that's practicing law and thinking about going into startups, sales is maybe right for you because you've done a lot of the work. When I was an account manager, so somewhat sales, and wanted to transition to product management, I was like, how does this translate over? But one of the biggest things that has transitioned for me is communication. Where you're an account manager, you're dealing with so many people, especially clients, you got to keep them happy, you got to over communicate, you got to be proactive. And now that is serving me tremendously as a product manager because I know how to communicate with everyone around me, keep them up to date, being proactive. And so to your point, a lot of things do transfer over. The second is, as we've talked, when it comes to job descriptions at startups, like when you read it and you're like, am I qualified for this or not? You got to know that the things listed on there are not going to be the things you're mostly like going to be working on. It's like a lot of other things that you're going to be doing. So it's just like, does this make sense? And then how do I translate what I do to this startup? And then to that point though, when you're like casting a net of what doesn't work, great place, because you got to have urgency, as you mentioned, great place to be like, okay, I'm going to test this out. Like, I don't have to do my job, but I'm going to test this other thing out and like, see if I like it. And if you don't, you know, that's not for you. So you'll quickly figure out what things you do, you don't like. And you're right. At early in your career, it's great, but also like for others who are later in their career, that's another way of like moving around. And then lastly, to your point of when you're constantly thinking about the problems, like it doesn't matter if you're the founder or not, it will come up and you're like, oh man, like I got it. This is either too good. Anything about it was like, oh crap, we didn't think about that. For example, this morning I woke up, I was like, I didn't think about this. I didn't figure this out. So all great points. And I appreciate you highlighting all of those. With that, let's bring it home. So a few rapid questions for you before we close things out. Fill in the blank for me. Working at an early stage company is?
Exciting.
Exciting. It's definitely exciting. Looking back on your career, and even now, or when you were doing your own thing or being in law, who have been one or two individuals have been influential in your life, whether it's career or personal or an overlap, that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Shout out to a couple of people. One, family, super supportive. When you tell someone, hey, not doing law, I'm going to do education, they'll be like, what? My parents are awesome. Shout out to them. Also amazing, because I learned a bunch of business lessons from my dad because he's run a massive company. So that's awesome. Two, I'd say my co-founder at my former venture, great friend. He's also building a startup again. So rooting for him all the time. Three, a bunch of amazing former bosses when I was at a law firm. They also helped me do my due diligence when I was talking to a bunch of startups. Continue to be mentors to this day. A lot of them introduced me to some amazing people for Colum as well. And four, right now, Indus, who is my CEO, who is very much acting like a mentor to me. And it's been awesome working with him. So I know that was longer than a rapid fire, but I had to flag all four.
Yeah. No. Hey, it's important to call out the people that have helped us get to this point. Lastly, if you were not in tech, what would you do or what would you explore outside of this world?
Yeah, so this is a question I've actually thought about a lot. And funny answer, what I do is I travel the world and write about sport. So that's my dream alternate career. Yeah, my dream alternate career is to be a sports writer. So I write about it sometimes for myself, sometimes I publish something. But I absolutely love sport. I'm obsessed with it. I am coming to New York to watch the US Open later this year. So
that's awesome.
And then I'll be in the Bay Area for a couple of weeks as well. So I was like, hey, if I'm going to the Bay Area, I might as well go a little early and check out the tennis. So I think dream career would be in sports journalism if I wasn't doing something a little more conventional.
Yeah. Is there a particular sport that you're a little bit more passionate about than the others?
Yeah. Tennis is definitely number one. Been playing ever since I was a little kid. And I may just get a tattoo if my mom doesn't hear this conversation.
We'll be sure to not to tag her on LinkedIn when we post this. Okay. I know I said we're going to wrap it up, but now I got to know. How has playing tennis translated for you at a startup? Like, what key things from tennis are helping you now at the role that you're in?
Oh, I love this question because I've thought about it super deeply. I think that sport is like the best way to learn a lot of things. And I keep saying I learned more lessons outside the classroom than inside one. Also because I never studied. But I think that a bunch of things, right? One is you realize very quickly that you have to take decisions fast, but you also see patterns. So for example, if I'm serving to a guy with a weak backhand, I know under pressure, I'm going to go to his backhand, right? And so that pattern matching is very similar to realizing, hey, I've spoken to 5 CFOs of roughly 200 employee size. I realize they have these problems more than Y problems. But it's just pattern matching. You're taking it from a tennis court to a sales court, right? The other thing is, I just think sheer discipline, right? When you're playing sport, even semi-seriously at a university level, you're training hard and you care about it, right? And I think a lot of that translates to a lot of benefits. I think my first job was super intense. I would work very long hours. But a lot of it was down to discipline that I think I built over time. So I think discipline is definitely another one. And third is, and this is more true for doubles again, when you play doubles, you realize a lot of it is about communication and making sure that even, let's say you lose a point or you lose a pressure point or you drop a game you shouldn't have, you can't take it out on your partner because you're one team. So it's a combination of communication for every point and making smart decisions every point. But also the whole aspect of how people work in teams together. So I play a lot of team sport as well. But tennis, of course, is my favorite. But I think that's one lesson that stayed with me for a long time in terms of your teammate is your teammate. And they're going to be your teammate. And a lot of my best friends are people who I've either played tennis with or people I've done a lot of quizzing or trivia with, debate friends. So a lot of my friends are people who are teammates in some capacity. And I think there's like a almost magical relationship.
Yeah. God, I love that. As you're talking about this, and honestly, I hadn't thought about this, is thinking about my college days of playing rugby. It's been a long time since then, but I just remember like communication is so huge as a team, especially when you have 15 people running around on a rugby pitch, making sure you're all aligned. But so I appreciate you invoking that thought in my mind. Sanjay, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for coming on, taking the time and sharing your experience with us.
Thanks, Shahin. I think I had a lot of fun.
If you stuck around and are still here, thank you so much again for taking the time out of your day to join us and to listen to this episode. Whether you enjoyed it or not, I'd love to hear from you as your feedback helps make the show better. Please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating or review on the platform that you listen to this show. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram or LinkedIn, both under the name or handle The Early Team. Catch y'all soon. Bye!